She had had to hide someone from her son. More than a dozen tombs stood in the vault. Sleeping stone figures lay on top of most of them, with swords on their breasts, dogs at their feet, pillows of marble or granite under their heads. Violante hurried past them without a glance, until she stopped by a coffin with a plain stone lid cracked right down the middle, as if the dead man inside had once pushed it open.
"If the Blue Jay isn't here, we'll go and scare Balbulus a bit, shall we?"
There was jealousy in Jacopo's voice when he uttered Balbulus's name, as if he were talking about an older brother whom his mother preferred to him.
"We'll go back, and you can make fire lick around those books of his."
The soldier's young face flushed red with effort as he heaved the lower part of the coffin lid aside. Mo kept his knife in his hand as he climbed into the sarcophagus. There was no dead body in it, but all the same Mo felt he could hardly breathe as he stretched out in the cold, cramped space. The coffin had clearly been made for a smaller man. Had Violante thrown his bones away so that she could hide her spies inside it? The darkness was almost total when the soldier pushed the cracked lid back into place. A little light and air came in through a few holes forming a flower pattern. "Breathe steadily, Mo. Breathe calmly," he told himself. He still had the knife in his hand. It was a pity none of the stone swords the dead were holding would be any use. "Do you really think it's worth risking your own skin for a few painted goat skins?" Batista had inquired when he asked him to make the clothes and the belt. "What a fool you are, Mortimer. Hasn't this world done enough to show you how dangerous it is?" But Balbulus's painted goatskins had been very beautiful. A knock. A bolt was pushed back. The voices came to his ears more distinctly now. Footsteps. Mo tried to peer through the holes, but he could see only another coffin and the black hem of Violante's dress disappearing as she walked quickly away. His eyes weren't going to help him. He let his head sink back onto the cold stone and listened. How loud his breathing was. Could there be any sound more suspicious here among the dead? "Suppose it isn't just by chance that Sukbird has turned up now," something inside him whispered. "Suppose Violante was only setting a trap for you. Not all daughters love their fathers. Suppose her ugliness was planning to give her father a very special present all the same. Look who I've caught for you, the Blue Jay. He was disguised as a crow. I wonder who he thought he'd fool that way."
"Your Highness!"
Sootbird's voice echoed through the vault as if he was standing right beside the coffin where Mo lay.
"Forgive us for disturbing you in your grief, but your son wants me to meet a visitor you received today. He insists on it. He thinks the man is an old and very dangerous acquaintance of mine."
"A visitor?"
Violante's voice sounded as cool as the stone beneath Mo's head.
"The only visitor down here is death, and it's not much use warning anyone against death, is it?"
Sootbird laughed uneasily.
"No, certainly not. But Jacopo was talking about a flesh-and-blood visitor, a bookbinder, tall, dark hair."
"Balbulus was interviewing a bookbinder today," Violante replied. "He's been looking for one for a long time now, someone who knows his trade better than the bookbinders of Umbra."
What was that noise? Of course, Jacopo, hopping about on the flagstones. Obviously he sometimes acted like any other child after all. The hopping came closer. The temptation simply to stand up instead of lying there was very strong. It was difficult to keep your body as still as a corpse while you were still breathing. Mo closed his eyes so as not to see the stone around him. "Keep your breath as shallow as you can," he told himself. "Breathe as quietly as the fairies." The hopping stopped right beside him.
"You've hidden him."
Jacopo's voice reached Mo inside the sarcophagus as if he were speaking the words for Mo's ears alone.
"Shall we look in the coffin, Sootbird?"
The boy seemed to find the notion very enticing, but Sootbird laughed nervously.
"Oh, I'm sure that won't be necessary. If we tell your mother who she's dealing with, this bookbinder could be the very man your father is looking for so desperately, Highness."
"The Blue Jay? The Blue Jay? Here, in the castle?"
Violante's voice sounded so incredulous that even Mo believed she was taken by surprise.
"Of course, I've told my father time and again, one day that robber's own daring will be his downfall. You're not to say a word of this to the milksop. I want to catch the Blue Jay myself, and then at last my father will realize who ought to be on the throne of Umbra. Have you reinforced the guards at the gates? Have you sent soldiers to Balbulus's workshop?
No. Sutbert was obviously confused. I mean, he isn't with Balbulus anymore. He...
What? You fool!
Violante's voice was as sharp as her father's.
Lower the portcullis over the gateway. At once. If my father hears that the Blue Jay was in this castle, in my library, and simply rode away again...
How menacing she made those words sound in the chilly air. She was indeed clever. Her son was right.
Sandro?
That must be one of her soldiers.
Tell the guards at the main gates to lower the portcullis. No one is to leave the castle. No one, do you hear? I only hope it's not too late already. Jacopo! Yes?
There was fear and defiance in the high voice, and a trace of distrust.
If he finds the gates closed, where could the Blue Jay hide? You know every hiding place in this castle, don't you?
Of course. Now Jacopo sounded flattered.
I can show you all of them. Good. Take three of the guards from outside the throne room upstairs and post them at the most likely hiding places you know. I'll go and talk to Balbulus, the Blue Jay, in my castle.
Sutbert stammered something. Violante brusquely interrupted him, ordering him to go with her. Their footsteps and voices moved away, but Mo thought he could still hear them for some time on the endless stairs leading up and away from the dead, back to the world of the living, to the daylight where you could breathe easily. Even when all was perfectly still again, he lay there for a few more agonizing moments, listening until he felt as if he could hear the dead themselves breathing. Then he braced his hands against the stone lid and hastily reached for his knife when he heard footsteps again.
Blue Jay.
It was no more than a whisper. The cracked lid was pushed aside, and the soldier, who had helped him into his hiding place, reached out a hand to him.
We must hurry, he whispered. The milksop has raised the alarm. There are guards everywhere. But Violante knows ways out of this castle that even Jacopo hasn't found yet. I hope, he added.
As Mo clambered out of the sarcophagus, legs stiff from lying in its cramped space, he still had the knife in his hand. The boy stared at it.
How many have you killed?
His voice sounded almost awe-stricken, as if killing were a high art, like the painting of Balbulus. How old would the lad be? 14, 15? He looked younger than Farid. How many? What was he to say to that? Only a few months ago, the answer would have been so simple. Perhaps he'd even have laughed out loud at such a ridiculous question. Now he just said, not as many as those who lie here, although he wasn't sure that he was telling the truth. The boy looked along the rows of the dead, as if counting them.
Is it easy?
Judging by the curiosity in his eyes, he really didn't seem to know the answer, despite the sword at his side and his shirt of chain mail.
Yes, thought Mo, yes, it's easy. If you have a second heart beating in your breast, cold and sharp-edged as the sword you carry, a certain amount of hatred and anger, a few weeks of fear and helpless rage, and you'll have a heart like that. It beats time for you when you come to kill, a wild, fast rhythm, and only later do you feel your other heart again, soft and warm. It shudders in time with the other one at the thought of what you did. It trembles and feels pain. But that's only afterward. The boy was still looking at him. Killing is too easy, said Mo. Dying is harder. Although Cosimo's stony smile claimed otherwise. Didn't you say we must hurry? The boy turned red under his shiny polished helmet.
Yes, yes, of course.
A stone lion kept watch in front of a niche behind the coffins, the emblem of Umbra on its breast. Presumably the only example of the old coat of arms that the milksop hadn't had smashed. The soldier put his sword between the lion's bared teeth, and the wall of the vault opened just far enough for a grown man to squeeze through it. Hadn't Fenoglio described this entrance? Words that Mo had read long ago came back to his mind, about one of Cosimo's ancestors who had escaped his enemies several times along the passage beyond. And words will save the Blue Jay again, he thought. Well, why not? He's made of them. All the same, his fingers passed over the stone as if they needed to reassure themselves that the walls of the vault weren't just made of paper. The passage comes out above the castle, the boy whispered to him. Violante couldn't get your horse from the stables. It would have attracted too much attention, but there'll be another waiting there. The forest will be swarming with soldiers, so be careful. And I'm to give you these. Mo put his hand into the saddlebags that the boy handed him. Books. Violante says I'm to tell you they're a present for you, made in the hope that you will accept the alliance she offers you. The passage was endless, almost as oppressively narrow as the sarcophagus, and Mo was glad when at last he saw the light of day again. The way out was little more than a crack between a couple of rocks. The horse was waiting under the trees, and he saw Umbra Castle, the guards on the walls, the soldiers pouring out of the gates like a swarm of locusts. Yes, he would have to be very careful. All the same, he undid the saddlebags, hid among the rocks, and opened one of the books. Chapter 10. As if nothing had happened. Farid was holding Meggie's hand. He let her bury her face in his shirt, while he kept whispering that everything would be all right. But the Black Prince still wasn't back, and the crow sent out by Gecko brought the same news as Doria, the strongman's younger brother, who had been spying for the robbers ever since Snapper had saved him and his friend from hanging. The alarm had been raised at the castle. The portcullis was lowered, and the guards at the gate were boasting that the Blue Jay's head would soon be looking down on Umbra from the castle battlements. The strong man had taken Meggie and Risa to the robbers' camp, although they would both have preferred to go back to Umbra.
"That's what the Blue Jay would want,"
was all he had said, and the Black Prince set off with Batista to the farm they'd called home for the last few weeks. Such happy weeks, so deceptively peaceful in the turmoil of Finolio's world. "We'll bring you your things," was all the prince had said when Risa asked him what he was going there for. "You can't go back." Neither Risa nor Meggie asked why. They both knew the answer. Because the milksop would have the Blue Jay questioned, and no one could be sure that a time wouldn't come when Mo might reveal where he had been hiding during those recent weeks. The robbers themselves moved camp only a few hours after hearing of Mo's arrest.
"The milksop has some very talented torturers," Snapper remarked,
and Risa sank down under the trees away from the others and buried her face in her arms. Finolio had stayed in Umbra.
"Perhaps they'll let me see Violante, and Minerva's working in the castle kitchen tonight. Maybe she'll find out something there. I'll do everything I can, Meggie,"
he had promised as he said goodbye.
"Like getting into bed and drinking 2 jugs of wine," was all Farid said to that,
but he kept remorsefully silent when Meggie began to cry. Why had she let Mo ride to Umbra? If only she'd at least gone to the castle with him, but she'd wanted to be with Farid so much. She saw the same accusation in her mother's eyes. "You could have stopped him, Meggie. No one else but you could have done it." When darkness began to fall, Woodenfoot brought them something to eat. His stiff leg had earned him his name. Although not the fastest of the robbers, he was a good cook. But neither Meggie nor Risa could swallow a morsel. It was bitterly cold, and Farid tried to persuade Meggie to sit by the fire with him. But she just shook her head. She wanted to be alone with herself in the dark. The strong man brought her a blanket. His brother was with him, Doria.
"Not much good at poaching, but he's a first-class spy,"
the strong man had whispered to her when he introduced them. The two brothers were not very much alike, although they had the same thick brown hair, and Doria was already strong for his age, something that filled Farid with envy. He wasn't very tall. Doria only just came up to his elder brother's shoulder, and his eyes were as blue as the skin of Finolia's fairies, while the strong man's eyes were acorn brown.
"We have different fathers,"
the strong man had explained when Meggie expressed her surprise at the difference between them.
"Not that either of them's worth a lot."
"You mustn't worry."
Doria's voice sounded very grown up. Meggie raised her head. He put the blanket around her shoulders and stepped shyly back when she looked up at him. But he did not avoid her eyes. Doria looked everyone in the face, even Snapper, and most people looked away from Snapper.
"Your father will be all right, believe me. He'll outwit them all. The milksop, the adderhead, the piper." "After they've hanged him?" asked Maggie. She sounded as bitter as she felt, but Doria just shrugged his shoulders.
"Nonsense. They were going to hang me too," he said. "He's the Blue Jay. He and the Black Prince will save us all. You wait and see."
He made it sound as if it couldn't turn out any other way, as if he, Doria, were the only one who had read to the end of Fenolio's story. But Snapper, sitting under the trees with Gecko only a little way off, laughed hoarsely.
"Your brother's as big a fool as you," he called over to the strong man. "It's his bad luck he doesn't have your muscles, so I guess he won't live to be very old. The Blue Jay is finished. And what does he leave behind as his legacy? The immortal Adderhead."
The strong man clenched his fists and was about to go for Snapper, but Doria pulled him back when Gecko drew his knife and rose to his feet. The two of them often quarreled, but suddenly they both raised their heads and listened. A jay was calling in the oak above them.
"He's back! Maggie, he's back!"
Farid climbed down from his lookout post so fast that he almost lost his balance. The fire had burned low. Only the stars shone down into the dark ravine where the robbers had pitched their new camp. And Maggie didn't see Mo until Woodenfoot limped over to him with a torch.
Batista and the Black Prince were with him. They all seemed unharmed.
Doria turned to her.
"Well, Blue Jay's daughter,"
his smile seemed to be saying.
"What did I tell you?"
Risa jumped up in such haste that she stumbled over her blanket. She made her way through the crowd of robbers standing around Mo and the prince. As if in a dream, Maggie followed her. It was too good not to be a dream. Mo was still wearing the black clothes that Batista had made him. He looked tired, but he did indeed seem to be uninjured.
"It's all right. Everything's all right," Maggie heard him say, as he kissed the tears from her mother's face.
And when Maggie was there in front of him, he smiled at her as if this were their old life. And he had only been on a short journey to cure a few sick books, not come from a castle where people wanted to kill him.
"I've brought you something," he whispered to her.
And only the way he hugged her so tight and for so long told her that he had been as frightened as she was.
"Leave him alone, will you?"
the Black Prince told his men as they crowded around Mo, wanting to know how the Blue Jay had escaped from Umbra Castle as well as the Castle of Night.
"You'll hear the story soon enough, and now double the guard."
They reluctantly obeyed, sat around the dying fire grumbling, or disappeared into the tents that had been patched together out of pieces of fabric and old clothes, offering only scant shelter from nights that were growing colder all the time. But Mo beckoned Maggie and Risa over to his horse and delved into the saddlebags. He brought out two books, handling them as carefully as if they were living creatures. He gave one to Risa and one to Maggie, and laughed when Maggie snatched hers so quickly that she almost dropped it.
"It's a long time since the two of us had a book in our hands, right?"
he whispered to her with an almost conspiratorial smile.
"Open it. I promise you, you never saw a more beautiful book."
Risa had taken her book too, but she didn't even look at it. "Fenolio said that illuminator was the bait for you," she said in an expressionless voice. "He told us they arrested you in his workshop."
"It wasn't exactly what it seemed. As you can see, no harm came of it, or I wouldn't be here, would I?"
Mo said no more, and Risa asked no further questions. She didn't say a word when Mo sat down on the short grass in front of the horses and drew Maggie down beside him.
"Farid," he said,
and Farid left Batista, whom he was obviously trying to question about events in Umbra, and went over to Mo with the same awe on his face that Maggie had seen on Doria's.
"Can you make some light for us?" Mo asked,
and Farid kneeled down between them and made fire dance on his hands, although Maggie could clearly see that he didn't understand how the Blue Jay could sit there right after his narrow escape from the milksop soldiers, showing his daughter a book before he did anything else. Did you ever see anything so beautiful, Meggie? Mo whispered, as she caressed one of the gilded pictures with her finger. Apart from the fairies, of course, he added with a smile, as one of them, pale blue like the sky Balbulus painted, settled drowsily on the pages. Mo shooed away the fairy, as Dustfinger had always done, by blowing gently between her shimmering wings, and Meggie, beside him, bent her head over the pages and forgot her fears for him. She forgot Snapper, she even forgot Fareed, who didn't so much as glance at what she couldn't tear her own eyes away from. Lettering in sepia brown, as airy as if Balbulus had breathed it onto the parchment. Dragons, birds stretching their long necks at the heads of the pages, initials heavy with gold leaf, like shining buttons among the lines. The words danced with the pictures, and the pictures sang for the words, singing their colourful song.
Is that her ugliness?
Meggie laid a finger on the finely drawn figure of a woman. There she stood, slender beside the written lines, her face barely half the size of Meggie's little fingernail. Yet you could see the pale birthmark on her cheek.
Yes, and Balbulus made sure she'll still be recognized many hundreds of years from now.
Mo pointed to the name that the Illuminator had written in dark blue ink, clearly visible above the tiny head. Violante. The V had gold edging as fine as a hair.
I met her today. I don't think she deserves her nickname, Mo went on. She's rather too pale, and I think she could bear a grudge for a long time. But she fears nothing.
A leaf landed on the open book. Mo flicked it away, but it clung to his finger with thin, spidery arms.
Well, how about this? He said, holding it up to his eyes. Is it one of Orpheus's leaf men? His creations obviously spread fast.
And they're seldom very nice, said Fareed. Watch out! Those creatures spit!
Really?
Mo laughed softly, and let the leaf man fly away, just as it was pursing its lips. Risa watched the strange creature go, and abruptly straightened up.
It's all lies, she said.
Her voice shook on every word.
This beauty is a lie. It's just meant to take our minds off the darkness, all the misfortune, and all the death.
Mo put the book on Meggie's lap and got to his feet, but Risa stepped back.
This isn't our story,
she said, in a voice loud enough for some of the robbers to turn and look at her.
It's draining our hearts with all its magic. I want to go home. I want to forget all these horrors and not remember them until I'm back on Eleanor's sofa.
Gecko had turned, too. He stared curiously at them while one of his crows tried to snatch a piece of meat from his hand. Snapper was listening as well.
We can't go back, Risa, said Mo, lowering his voice. Fenolio isn't writing anymore, remember? And we can't trust Orpheus. Fenolio will try to write us back if you ask. He owes it to you.
Please, Mo. There can't be any happy ending here.
Mo looked at Meggie, who was still kneeling beside Fareed with Balbulus's book on her lap. What was he hoping for? Did he want her to contradict her mother? Fareed glared at Risa and let the fire between his fingers go out.
Silver Tongue?
Mo looked at him. Yes, he had many names now. What had it been like when he was only Mo? Probably Meggie couldn't remember either.
I must go back to Ombra. What am I to say to Orpheus?
Fareed looked at him almost pleadingly.
Will you tell him about the white women?
There it was again, like fire burning on his face, his foolish hope.
There's nothing to tell, I've said so before, replied Mo,
and Fareed bowed his head and looked at his sooty hands, as if Mo had snatched hope itself from his fingers. He stood up. He still went barefoot, even though there was sometimes frost at night now.
Good luck, Meggie,
he murmured, giving her a quick kiss. Then he turned without another word. Meggie was already missing him as he swung himself up onto his donkey.
Yes, perhaps they really ought to go back.
She jumped when Mo put his hand on her shoulder.
Keep the book wrapped in a cloth when you're not looking at it, he said. The nights are damp.
Then he made his way past her mother and went over to the robbers, who were sitting around the embers of their dying fire, as silently as if they were waiting for him. But Risa stood there, staring at the book in her hands, as if it were another book, the one that had swallowed her up entirely over 10 years ago. Then she looked at Meggy. "What about you?" she asked. "Do you want to stay here, like your father? Don't you miss your friends, and Eleanor, and Darius? And your warm bed without any lice in it? The cafe down by the lake? The peaceful roads?" Meggy wished so much she could give the answer that Risa wanted to hear, but she couldn't.
"I don't know,"
she said quietly. And that was the truth. Chapter 11. Sick with Longing. Eleanor had read countless stories in which the main characters fell sick at some point because they were so unhappy. She had always thought that a very romantic idea, but she dismissed it as a pure invention of the world of books. All those wilting heroes and heroines who suddenly gave up the ghost just because of unrequited love or longing for something they'd lost. Eleanor had always enjoyed their sufferings, as a reader will. After all, that was what you wanted from books. Great emotions you'd never felt yourself. Pain you could leave behind by closing the book if it got too bad. Death and destruction felt deliciously real, conjured up with the right words. And you could leave them behind between the pages as you pleased, at no cost or risk to yourself. Eleanor had wallowed in misery on the printed page, but she'd never thought that in real life, grey and uneventful as hers had been for many years, such pain could enter her own heart. "You're paying the price now, Eleanor," she often told herself these days. "Paying the price for the happiness of those last months. Didn't books say that too, that there's always a price to pay for happiness? How could she ever have thought she would simply find it to be allowed to keep it? Stupid, stupid Eleanor." When she didn't feel like getting up in the morning, when her heart faltered more and more frequently for no apparent reason, as if it were too tired to beat steadily, when she had no appetite even at breakfast time, although she had always preached that breakfast was the most important meal of the day, when Darius, with that anxious, owlish expression on his face, kept asking how she was, she began wondering whether becoming ill with longing was more than just a literary invention after all. Didn't she feel, deep down inside, that her longing was sapping her strength and her appetite, even her pleasure in her books? Longing. Darius suggested going away to auctions of rare books or famous bookshops that she hadn't visited for a long time. He drew up lists of volumes not yet in her library, lists that would have filled Eleanor with delighted excitement only a year ago. But now her eyes passed over the titles with as little interest as if she were reading a shopping list for cleaning products. What had become of her love for printed pages and precious bindings, words on parchment and paper? She missed the tug at her heart that she used to feel at the sight of her books, the need to stroke their spines tenderly, open them, lose herself in them. But it seemed as if all of a sudden her heart couldn't enjoy or feel anything, as if the pain had numbed it to everything but her longing for Meggy and her parents. Because by now Eleanor had understood this too. A longing for books was nothing compared with what you could feel for human beings. The books told you about that feeling. The books spoke of love, and it was wonderful to listen to them, but they were no substitute for love itself. They couldn't kiss her like Meggy. They couldn't hug her like Risa. They couldn't laugh like Mortimer. Poor books. Poor Eleanor. She began spending days on end in bed. She ate too little and then too much. Her stomach hurt. Her head ached. Her heart fluttered inside her. She was cross and absent-minded and began crying like a crocodile over the most sentimental stories. Because, of course, she went on reading. What else was there for her to do? She read and read and read, but she was stuffing herself with the letters on the page, like an unhappy child stuffing itself with chocolate. They didn't taste bad, but she was still unhappy. And Orpheus's ugly dog lay beside her bed, slobbering on her carpet and staring at her with his sad eyes, as if he were the only creature in the world who understood her sorrows. Well, perhaps that wasn't quite fair. Presumably Darius, too, knew just how wretched she was feeling.
"Eleanor, won't you go for a little walk?"
he would ask when he had brought her breakfast in bed yet again, and she still hadn't appeared in the kitchen by 12 noon.
"Eleanor, I found this wonderful edition of Ivanhoe in one of your catalogues. Why don't we go and take a look at it? The place isn't far away."
Or, as he had said only a few days ago,
"Please, Eleanor, go and see the doctor. This can't go on."
"The doctor?" she snapped at the poor man. "And what do you expect me to say to him? Well, doctor, it seems to be my heart. It feels this ridiculous yearning for 3 people who disappeared into a book. Do you have any pills for that kind of thing?"
Of course, Darius had had no answer. Without a word, he had just put down her tea with honey and lemon, her favorite, beside the bed among the mountains of books piled on her bedside table, and gone downstairs again, looking so sad that Eleanor had a shockingly guilty conscience. All the same, she didn't get up. She stayed in bed for 3 more days, and when she dragged herself into her library on the 4th day, still in her nightdress and dressing gown to get something else to read, she found Darius holding the sheet of paper, the one that had taken Orpheus to the place where Eleanor supposed Risa, Meggie, and Mortimer still were.
"What on earth are you doing?" she asked, horrified. "No one touches that piece of paper, understand? No one!"
Darius put the sheet back in its place and wiped a speck off the glass case with his sleeve.
"I was only looking at it," he said in his gentle voice. "Orpheus really doesn't write badly, does he? Although it sounds very much like Fenolio."
"Which is why it can hardly be described as Orpheus's writing," said Eleanor scornfully. "He's a parasite, a louse, preying on other writers, except that he feeds on their words, not their blood. Even his name is stolen from another poet, Orpheus."
"Yes, I expect you're right," said Darius as he carefully closed the glass case again. "But perhaps you should call him a forger instead. He copies Fenolio's style so perfectly that at first glance you can't tell the difference.
It would be interesting to see how he writes when he has to work without a model. Can he paint pictures of his own? Pictures that don't look like someone else's?"
Darius looked at the words under the glass lid, as if they could answer his question.
"Why would I be interested in that? I hope he's dead and gone, trodden underfoot."
Grim-faced, Eleanor went up to the shelves and took out 6 books, supplies for another cheerless day in bed.
"Yes, trodden underfoot by a giant, or... no, wait, even better. I hope his clever tongue is blue and sticking out of his mouth because they've hanged him."
That brought a smile to Darius's owlish face.
"Eleanor, Eleanor," he said, "I think you could teach the Adderhead himself the meaning of fear."
"Of course I could," replied Eleanor. "Compared to me, the white women are a bunch of sisters of mercy. But I'm stuck for the rest of my life in a story where there's no part for me but the role of a batty old woman."
Darius didn't reply to that. However, when Eleanor came downstairs again that evening to find another book, he was standing in front of the glass case once more, looking at the words Orpheus had written on the sheet of paper. Chapter 12. Back in the Service of Orpheus. Of course, the city gates of Ombra were closed when Farid finally rode his stubborn donkey around the last bend in the road. A thin crescent moon shone down on the castle towers, and the guards were passing the time by throwing stones at the bones dangling from the gallows outside the city walls. The milksop had left some skeletons hanging there, though to spare his sensitive nose, the gallows were no longer in use. Presumably, he thought that gallows left empty were too reassuring a sight for his subjects.
"Well, well, who comes here?" grunted one of the guards,
a tall, thin fellow propping himself on his spear, as if his legs alone wouldn't carry him.
"Take a look at this laddie," he added,
roughly seizing Farid's reins.
"Riding around all on his own in the middle of the night. Aren't you afraid the blue jay will steal that donkey from under your skinny behind? After all, He had to leave his horse up at the castle today, so he could do with your donkey. And you, he'll feed to the Black Prince's bear. I've heard the bear eats nothing but men-at-arms, because they crunch so nicely in his jaws.
As a precaution, Farid's hand went to his knife. He felt too tired to be humble, and perhaps it made him lightly reckless to know that the blue jay had managed to get out of the milksop's castle safe and sound. Yes, he too found himself calling Silvertongue by that name more and more often, although Meggie was always cross if she heard him.
Ho, ho! Hark at the lad, will you, Rizzo? Called the guard to the other man on duty. Maybe he stole the donkey himself to sell to the sausage maker in Butcher's Alley before the poor beast drops dead under him.
Rizzo came closer, smiling unpleasantly, and raised his lance until the ugly spearhead was pointing straight at Farid's chest.
I know this fellow, he said.
He had two missing front teeth, which made him hiss like a snake.
Saw him breathing fire once or twice in the marketplace. Aren't you the one they say learned his trade from the fire dancer?
Yes, what about it?
Farid's stomach muscles contracted. They always did when Dustfinger was mentioned.
What about it?
Rizzo prodded him with a spearhead.
Get off your decrepit donkey and give us a bit of a show. Maybe we'll let you into the city afterward.
They did finally open the gates, after he had turned night into day for almost an hour for their pleasure, making the fire grow flowers, as he had learned to do from Dustfinger. Farid still loved the flames, even though the crackling of their voices reminded him only too painfully of the man who had taught him all about them. But he no longer made them dance in public. He did it only for himself. The flames were all that was left to him of Dustfinger, and sometimes, when he missed him so much that his heart was numb with longing, he wrote his name in fire on a wall somewhere in Umbra and stared at the letters until they went out, leaving him alone, just as Dustfinger had left him alone. Now that Umbra had lost its menfolk, it was usually as quiet as a city of the dead by night. Tonight, however, Farid ran into several troops of soldiers. The blue jay had stirred them up like a wasp's nest, and they were still buzzing around, as if that would bring the bold intruder back. Lowering his head, Farid dragged the donkey past them, and was glad when he finally reached Orpheus's house. It was a magnificent building, one of the finest in Umbra, and the only one on this unrestful night with candlelight still shining through the windows. Torches burned at the entrance. Orpheus lived in constant terror of thieves, and their flickering light brought to life the stone gargoyles above the gate. Farid always shuddered to see them stare down with their bulging eyes, their mouths wide open, their nostrils distended, looking as if they were about to snort in his face. He tried to put the torches to sleep with a whisper, as Dustfinger often did, but the fire wasn't listening to him. That happened more and more often now, as if to remind him that a pupil whose master was dead was a pupil forever. He was so tired. The dogs barked at him as he led the donkey across the yard to its stable. Back again. Back in the service of Orpheus. He would so much rather have rested his head in Meggie's lap or sat by the fire with Silvertongue and the Black Prince. But for Dustfinger's sake, he always came back here, again and again. Farid let Jink climb out of the rucksack onto his shoulder and looked up at the stars as if he could find Dustfinger's scarred face there. Why didn't he appear to him in a dream and tell him how to bring him back? Didn't the dead sometimes do that for those they loved? Or did Dustfinger come only to Roxanne, as he had promised, and to his daughter? No. If Brianna was visited by any dead man, it was Cosimo. The other maids said she whispered his name in her sleep, and sometimes put out her hand to him, as if he were lying beside her. Perhaps he doesn't appear to me in my dreams, because he knows I'm afraid of ghosts, thought Farid, as he climbed the steps to the back door. The main entrance of the house, which led straight out into the square, was of course reserved for Orpheus himself and his fine customers. Servants, strolling players, and delivery men had to plough through the muck in the yard and ring the bell at the modest little door, hidden at the back of the house. Farid rang 3 times, but nothing stirred.
By all the demons of the desert, where was that chunk?
He had nothing to do but open a door now and then. Or was he snoring away like a dog outside Orpheus's bedroom door again? However, when the bolt was finally pushed aside, it wasn't Os who let him in, but Brianna. Dustfinger's daughter had been working for Orpheus for 2 weeks now, but presumably Cheeseface had no idea whose daughter was doing his laundry and scrubbing his pots. Orpheus was so blind. Without a word, Brianna held the door open, and Farid was equally silent as he passed her. There were no words between them, except those that went unspoken. My father died for you. He left us alone for you, only for you. Brianna blamed him for every tear her mother shed. She had told him so in a low voice after their first day together in the service of Orpheus. For every single tear. Yet again he thought he felt her glance on the back of his neck like a curse when he turned his back to her.
Where have you been all this time?
Os seized him as he was stealing away to the place in the cellar where he slept. Jink hissed and ran off. Last time Os kicked the marten, he had almost broken Jink's ribs.
He's been asking for you 100 times over. Made me search every damn alleyway. I haven't had a wink of sleep all night because of you.
So, you sleep enough as it is.
The chunk hit him in the face.
Less of your cheek. Go on. Your master's waiting for you.
One of the maids came toward them on the stairs. She blushed as she made her way past Farid. What was her name?
Dana.
A nice girl. She'd often slipped him a delicious piece of meat when Os had stolen his food, and Farid had kissed her in the kitchen a few times for that. But she wasn't half as beautiful as Meggie, or Brianna.
I just hope you'll let me give you a good hiding,
Os whispered, before knocking on the door of Orpheus's study. That was what Orpheus called the room. Although he spent far less time studying in it than groping under one of the maid's skirts, or stuffing himself with the lavish dishes his cook had to prepare for him at any time of the day or night. Tonight, however, he really was sitting at his desk, head bent over a sheet of paper, while his 2 glass men were arguing under their breath over whether it was better to stir ink to the left or the right. They were brothers called Jasper and Ironstone, and as different as day and night. Ironstone, the elder, loved lecturing his younger brother and ordering him about. Farid often wanted to wring his glass neck. He himself had 2 older brothers. They'd been one of the reasons why he had run away from home and joined a band of robbers.
Shut up!
Orpheus snapped at the quarreling glassmen.
What ridiculous creatures you are! Stir to the left, stir to the right! Just make sure you don't spatter my whole desk with ink again while you're stirring.
Ironstone looked accusingly at Jasper. Of course. If anyone had spattered Orpheus's desk with ink, it had to be his little brother. But he preserved a grim silence as Orpheus put pen to paper again.
Farid, you really must learn to read.
How often had Meggie told him that? And with some difficulty, she had taught him a few letters of the alphabet. B for bear, R for robber.
Look, Farid. There's a letter R in your name, too.
M for Meggie. F for fire. Wasn't it wonderful that his name began with the same letter? And D. D for Dustfinger. He always got the rest mixed up. How are you supposed to remember those funny little things with their scrawled lines stretching every which way? A-O-U-I-M-T-N-P? It gave him a headache just to look at them. But yes, he must learn to read. He must. How else was he ever to find out whether Orpheus was really trying to write Dustfinger back?
Snippets. Nothing but snippets.
Orpheus pushed Jasper aside with a curse as the glassman came up to sprinkle sand over the fresh ink. Grimly, he tore the sheet of paper he had been writing on into tiny scraps. Farid was used to that sight. Orpheus was seldom satisfied with what he put down on paper. He crumpled up what he had written, tore it in pieces, threw it on the fire with a curse, bullied the glassmen, and drank too much. But when he succeeded, he was even more unbearable. He puffed himself up like a bullfrog, stalked proudly through Umbra like a newly crowned king, kissed the maids with his moist, complacent lips, and let everyone know he had no equal. "Let them call the old man Inkweaver," he shouted, loudly enough to be heard all over the house. "It suits him. He's nothing but a craftsman, while I am an enchanter. Ink enchanter. That's what they ought to call me. That's what they will call me someday." But tonight, yet again, the enchantment didn't seem to be working. "Toad twaddle, goose cackle, leaden words," he said angrily without raising his head. "Just a mush of words. That's what you're smearing the paper with today, Orpheus. A watery, unseasoned, tasteless, slimy mush of words." Two glass men hastily scrambled down the legs of the desk and began picking up the shreds of paper.
"My lord, the boy is back."
No one could sound more servile than Os. His voice bowed to Orpheus as readily as his massive body, but his fingers held the nape of Farid's neck in a steely grip. Orpheus turned, his face like thunder, and stared at Farid as if he had finally pinpointed the reason for his failure. "Where the devil have you been? With Fenolio all this time, or helping your girlfriend's father to steal into the castle and out again?" "Oh, yes. I've heard about his latest exploit. Presumably they'll be singing the first bad songs about it tomorrow. That fool of a bookbinder really does play the ridiculous part the old man wrote him with touching enthusiasm." Envy and contempt mingled in Orpheus's voice, as they so often did when he spoke of Silvertongue.
"He's not playing a part. He is the Blue Jay."
Farid trod on Os's foot hard enough to make him let go of his neck, and when the man tried to grab it again, he pushed him away. With a grunt, the chunk raised his big fist, but a glance from Orpheus halted him.
"Oh, really? Have you joined the ranks of his admirers, too?"
He put a clean sheet of paper on his desk and stared at it, as though that could fill it with the right words.
"Jasper, what are you doing down there?" he snapped at the glass man. "How often do I have to tell you two that the maids can sweep up scraps of paper? Sharpen me another pen."
Farid picked up Jasper, put him on the desk, and earned a grateful smile. The younger glass man had to do all the unpleasant jobs. That was how his brother had fixed it. And sharpening pens was the most unpleasant of all, because the tiny blade they used slipped very easily. Only a few days ago, it had cut deeply into Jasper's matchstick-thin arm, and Farid had discovered that glass men bleed like humans. Jasper's blood was transparent, of course. It had dripped onto Orpheus's paper like liquid glass, and Ironstone had slapped his little brother's face and called him a clumsy fool. For that, Farid had mixed some beer with the sand Ironstone ate. Since then, Ironstone's limbs, usually clear as water, and he had been very proud of that, had been yellow as horse's piss. Orpheus went to the window.
"If you stay out and about so long again," he said to Farid over his shoulder, "I'll tell Os to beat you like a dog."
The chunk smiled, and Farid cursed silently as he contemplated them both. But Orpheus was still looking up at the black night sky with a morose expression.
"Would you believe it?" he said. "That old fool Fenolio didn't even go to the trouble of naming the stars in this world. No wonder I keep running out of words. What's the moon called here? You'd think his senile old brain might at least have bothered about that, but no, he just called it the moon, as if it were the same moon we saw from our windows in the other world."
"Perhaps it really is the same moon. It was in my story too," said Farid.
"Rubbish. Of course it was different."
Orpheus turned to the window again, as if he had to explain to the entire world out there how badly made it was.
"Fenolio, I ask him,"
he went on in the self-satisfied voice that Ironstone always listened to devoutly, as if it were announcing truths never heard before.
"Is death a woman or a man in this world, or is it perhaps just a door through which you pass into quite a different story,
one that you yourself unfortunately omitted to write.
How do I know, he says.
How does he know? Who else knows if he doesn't? He doesn't tell us in his book anyway.
In his book, Ironstone, who had climbed up onto the windowsill to join Orpheus, cast a reverent glance at the desk, where the last copy of Inkheart lay beside the sheet of paper on which Orpheus had been writing. Fareed wasn't sure whether the glass man really understood that his entire world, himself included, had presumably slipped out of that same book. It usually lay there open, for when Orpheus was writing, he kept leafing through it with restless fingers, in search of the right words. He never used a single word that couldn't be found in Inkheart, for he was firmly convinced that only words from Fenolio's story could learn to breathe in this world. Others were just ink on paper.
"Fenolio," I ask, "are the white women only servants?" Orpheus went on, as Ironstone hung on every word from his soft, too soft lips. "Do the dead stay with them, or do the white women take them somewhere else?" "I expect so," the old fool replies. "I once told Minerva's children about a castle made of bones to comfort them for Cloud Dancer's death, but I was only talking off the cuff." "Off the cuff? Ha! The old fool," repeated Ironstone like an echo, but in his reedy glass man's voice it was not a very impressive sound. Orpheus turned and went back to his desk. "With all your roaming around, I hope at least you didn't forget to tell Mortimer I want to talk to him. Or was he too busy playing the hero?"
"He says there's nothing to talk about. He says he doesn't know anything about the white women, except what everyone knows."
"Oh, wonderful."
Orpheus reached for one of the pens that Jasper had sharpened so laboriously and snapped it in two.
"Did you at least ask whether he still sees them sometimes?"
"I'm sure he does."
Jasper's voice was as delicate as his limbs.
"Once the white women have touched someone, they never let him go. Or so the moss women say."
"I know that," said Orpheus impatiently. "I tried questioning a moss woman about that rumor, but the nasty creature wouldn't talk about it. She just stared at me with her mousy eyes and said I eat too much rich food and drink too much wine."
"They talk to the fairies," Jasper said, "and fairies talk to glass men. Although not all of them," he added with a sidelong glance at his brother. "I've heard that the moss women tell another tale of the white women, too. They say they can be summoned by anyone whose heart they've already touched with their cold fingers."
"Oh, indeed." Orpheus looked thoughtfully at the glass man. "I hadn't heard that one before."
"And it's not true. I've tried summoning them," said Fareed, "again and again."
"You? How often do I have to explain that you died much too quickly?"
Orpheus snapped contemptuously at him.
"You were in a great hurry to die, and just as great a hurry to come back. What's more, you're such a poor catch that I'd assume they don't even remember you. No, you're not the person to do it."
He went to the window again.
"Go and make me some tea," he told Fareed without turning.
"I have to think."
"What kind of tea?"
Fareed put Jasper on his shoulder. He took the little man with him whenever he could, to keep him safe from his big brother. Sometimes, when Orpheus didn't need either of them because he was taking his pleasure with one of the maids, or seeing his tailor for yet another fitting of some new clothes, which could last hours, Fareed took Jasper with him to Seamstress's Alley, where the glass women helped to thread the dressmaker's needles, tread seams smooth with their tiny feet, and tack lace to costly silk. For Fareed had now also learned that glass men don't just bleed, they fall in love too. And Jasper was head over heels in love with a girl who had pale yellow limbs. He was only too fond of watching her in secret, through her mistress's workshop window.
"What kind of tea? How should I know? Something good for a stomach ache," replied Orpheus crossly. "I've had a pain in my belly all day, as if there were stag beetles in it. How am I supposed to get anything sensible down on paper in that state?"
Of course, Orpheus always complained of a stomach ache or a headache when his writing wasn't going well. "I hope his belly torments him all night," thought Fareed, as he closed the study door behind him.
I hope it plagues him until he writes something for Dustfinger at last.
Chapter 13. A Knife Through the Heart.
At least he didn't tell you to go for the physician.
Jasper was doing his best to cheer up Fareed, who was carrying him down the steep stairs to the kitchen. Yes, indeed, the physician, who lived beyond the city gate. Orpheus had sent Fareed there only a few days ago. If you went to fetch him at night, he threw logs of wood at you, or came to the door brandishing one of the pairs of pincers he used to draw teeth.
"Stomach ache, headache," said Fareed crossly. "Cheese face has been overeating again, that's all." 3 roast gold mockers filled with chocolate, fairy nuts roasted in honey, and half a suckling pig stuffed with chestnuts," said Jasper, counting it up.
Then he ducked in alarm as he saw Jink by the kitchen door. The marten made Jasper nervous, even though Fareed kept assuring him that while martens did like to chase glass men, they never ever ate them. There was only one maid still in the kitchen. Fareed stopped in the doorway when he saw it was Brianna. That was all he needed. She was scrubbing the pots and pans from supper, her beautiful face grey with exhaustion. The working day began for Orpheus's maids before sunrise, and often didn't end until the moon was high in the sky. Orpheus himself made a tour of inspection of the whole house every morning, looking for cobwebs and dust, a speck on one of the mirrors that hung everywhere, a tarnished silver spoon, or a shirt that still showed a dirty mark after laundering. If he found anything, he would deduct a sum from all the maid's paltry wages on the spot. And he almost always did find something.
"What do you want?"
Brianna turned, wiping her wet hands on her apron.
"Orpheus has a stomach ache," muttered Fareed without looking at her, "and to make him some tea."
Brianna went to one of the kitchen dressers and took an earthenware jar off the top shelf. Fareed didn't know which way to look as she poured hot water on the herbs. Her hair was the same color as her father's, but wavy, and it shone in the candlelight like the red-gold rings that the governor liked to wear on his thin fingers. The strolling players sang songs about Dustfinger's daughter and her broken heart.
"Why are you staring like that?"
She took a sudden step toward him. Her voice was so cutting that Fareed instinctively flinched back.
"Yes, I look like him, don't I?"
It was as if, all through the silence of the last few weeks, she had been sharpening her words until they were knives that she could thrust through his heart.
"You don't look in the least like him. I keep telling my mother so. You're only some good-for-nothing layabout who play-acted that he was my father's son, keeping up the pretense so long that in the end my father thought he had to die for you."
Every word a knife, and Fareed felt them piercing his heart. Brianna's eyes were not like her father's. She had her mother's eyes, and they looked at Fareed with the same hostility as Roxanne's. He wanted to hit her, to silence her beautiful mouth, but she resembled Dustfinger too much.
"You're a demon, an evil spirit bringing nothing but bad luck."
She handed him the ready-brewed tea.
"There, take Orpheus that, and tell him his stomach would feel better if he didn't eat so much."
Fareed's hands trembled as he took the mug.
"You don't know anything about it," he said hoarsely. "Nothing at all. I didn't want him to bring me back. Being dead felt much better."
But Brianna only looked at him with her mother's eyes and her father's face. And Fareed stumbled back up to Orpheus's room with the hot tea, while Jasper stroked his hair with his tiny glass hand, full of pity. Chapter 14. News from Umbra. Meggy liked it in the robbers' camp. Sometimes it almost seemed to Risa as though her daughter had always dreamed of living in shabby tents. She watched Batista making himself a new mask, asked the strong man to teach her how to speak to the larks, and accepted the wildflowers that his younger brother brought her with a smile. It was good to see Meggy smiling again more often, although Fareed was still with Orpheus. But Risa missed the farm they had left behind. She missed the silence and seclusion, and the sense of being alone with Mo and Meggy after all the weeks when they had been apart. Weeks, months, years. Sometimes, when Risa saw the two of them sitting by the fire with the robbers, She felt almost as if she were watching them at a game they had played all through the years when she hadn't been with them.
Come on, Mo. Let's play robbers.
The Black Prince had advised Mo not to go outside the camp for the time being, and for a few days he took that advice.